Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Craig Hamilton of CitizenCraig.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Craig, good morning.
Good morning.
So, continuing our discussion of the Harry Potter films, we are at Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, also directed by Chris Columbus, released a year after Sorcerer's Stone in 2001. Where do you stand on this film? And remind me where you were at in your fandom. You didn't catch this one while it was going on, right?
I saw the movie.
Yeah,
I saw this one in theater like right when it came out.
Ah, okay, all right. So yeah. you were a fan at this point.
Yes. Okay. I was waiting with bated breath for this.
Excellent. Okay. Well, did it deliver then, and does it deliver now?
Yeah, it did deliver then because I actually finished the book right before I left to go to the theater.
Oh, cool.
And so just being able to see that world, put on film, on the big screen was just, it's, even though I was, college aged, I guess, or late teens, I was just ecstatic. It was awesome. And
awesome.
Now that we have all the other ones come out, it's great, but I think my thing with it is that it's the longest of any of the Harry Potter movies, all eight of them. It's the longest. And when you think about Sorcerer's Stone, it had background story, it had to establish this universe, and then it had to go on with the story and wrap it up. And that was, 9 minutes less than Chamber of Secrets, was all it really had to do was just tell a story, and it was longer. And so I think it feels long. The book itself isn't that much longer than the first book. So I feel like they just made a longer movie and without a whole lot more of information to put in a movie.
Yeah, that is something that I noticed because, like I said, my wife and I, we do the thing that I think everybody does these days, especially people with kids. We watch movies in parts, and I hate that. I wish that wasn't the case, but it's where we're at. So we were watching our second session, and it was the part where he's about to fight the basilisk. Like, we thought, okay, this is a good place to pause it. The basilisk is about to come out. Let's check and see this movie's almost finished, right? We turn on the status bar, and we still have 30 minutes left. And I was like, oh, Lord, this movie is really long. But when we finished it, so I was kind of, prepared to have that same criticism where it doesn't feel like there's an awful lot to support that running time. But then when we finished it, you have that moment at the end where Hagrid comes back, and there's this long extended sequence of all the whole hall applauding and happy, and everybody's together, and then there's this big grand pull out from the crowd of people, and there's a big pull out from the window and a big final wide shot of Hogwarts. And it felt in a weird way like the end of a school year. Like they totally recreated that feeling for me, and I realized that, I think a lot of that is because this was such a long movie and so much of it takes place at Hogwarts. We get there relatively quickly, or at least we get to Hogwarts-type business relatively quickly in the plot. And so I'm wondering if there's a reason, if that might be one of the reasons that I like this movie a bit more than Sorcerer's Stone. And really, this third viewing, I've liked it more than I ever have before. So there is something about the decompressed nature of the storytelling, the episodic nature of it, that makes it feel a little bit more special to me, that makes it feel more epic and more broad in scope. And there's some other elements that we'll get into later. But, yeah, I actually came away this time really liking this movie a lot more than I expected to.
Yeah, and someone, you haven't read the books, right?
No, never. I never will. I never will.
So that's something that's interesting, that you wanted to get to the Hogwarts business more quickly, and that may be why you like it more, you think? That was the point you made, right?
I think the worst part of every movie for me is the stuff at the Dursleys. It's always just like, you please make me, let me leave this area. That and Moaning Myrtle. Not only is Moaning Myrtle the worst part of any Harry Potter movie, it's also the worst part of movies since the beginning of the medium.
Well,
Moaning Myrtle is absolute the worst.
Well, it gives you peace of mind to know that she was murdered as a child. So hopefully that.
No,
gives you
because
some...
that's what put her into her state. I wish she had a long and prosperous life, graduated from Hogwarts, had grandkids, and died of natural causes. I wish that happened, because that would mean that she wouldn't have stuck around.
Interesting. I don't know. She might still be alive, but she wouldn't be at Hogwarts, is your point. I get it, yeah. So I think, for myself at least, and many readers, I think the plight of his, you know, circumstance at the Dursleys is so infuriating, and it seems to get worse. You know, the second one's worse than the first one. But I think people want to see these actors and actresses that play the Dursleys. They want to see that put on film. And eventually the movies just leave it out altogether, and for the sake of the story, which is important. But, I'd never really thought of it from that perspective. I just, it's almost like one of those things, like, well, we got to touch on, you know, how he got there, because it is important of his situation and how he leaves it and how he escapes it, because he's essentially escaping his caregivers. And that plays in a very important part later in the series. There's a reason he has to be there. So, yeah, but that's
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reason for him to be there, I don't think. I mean, hopping forward, that's never explained in the movies, right?
It would be in the sixth movie. I believe they touch on it in the beginning.
Okay. Interesting.
But again, is it really? They cut out the Dursley part, I believe. Yeah.
Interesting. So, I mean, while we're on the whole book to movie translation, and by the way, I do feel like that is a big part of you and I's specific conversation about these movies, is that you're coming at it very much as a fan of the books, and so translation is important to you. To me, I don't believe in books. I hate reading, unless it's the Bible, of course. So I have no use for the book.
And that's not always fun either.
No, it's always a pleasure. The Lord. I don't know what I'm doing right now. But my point is, it seems like the common thread here is that I'm coming at it very much from a strict, like, does it work as a movie, and not even as a plot movie, but as a movie, like, you know, visuals and keeping me engaged and things like that. And you're coming at it very much from a story perspective, which I think both perspectives are valid. Mine obviously more so, but I mean, this one, does it hold up to the first one? I know the first one is really really stuck well to the book. Does this one do as good of a job?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
From my memory, it's as good as any other ones, if not. It's definitely better than the next two or three. So.
The whole house elf thing, does that stick around in the books, or does that go away kind of like it does in the movies? Because it really doesn't in the movies. It doesn't come back till Deathly Hallows.
That is correct. It's completely cut out of Goblet of Fire, which is the fourth movie, and it plays a huge role in that book. But they cut it out, and it doesn't really hurt anything for cutting that out there. That's a huge book, and they would need to make two movies if they did that. But the House Elves play a huge role in the whole series, as you know, later on. But yeah, it's they stick around, but it's completely gutted from the fourth movie.
For some reason, I know this, but it's kind of like a social justice warrior aspect of Hermione's character. Is that right? She kind of has like a crusade for the House Elves. Okay. Yeah, that is something I kind of wish it stuck around, especially now that we see in Fantastic Beasts that, you know, subjugation and oppression is such a huge, subjugation and oppression of certain types of people is such a huge part of J.K. Rowling's vision for this universe, it does seem like that would have been a good thing to keep, and also to give Hermione a little bit more to do throughout the movies. I think if they had figured out a way to work that in, we'll talk about that more later, I guess.
Yeah, and Hermione is not a big part of her persona in the books. She's very smart and she's very talented, but that she brings that up every now and then. It's supposed to be a little annoying to the reader and some of the other characters in the fourth book, Goblet of Fire, that she's constantly doing this. But J.K. Rowling, when you talk about social things like this, now that we're seeing now that she was like 15 years ahead of it's such a huge thing now. It was a big thing then, but it's bigger now. And her portrayal of that.
She was like 30 years late, which
right.
is sad.
Yeah. Well,
that
could be it. It's probably just going in a cycle, but the whole house elf thing, she portrayed that in the books to mean like, it's magical, this magical tradition that the house elves are beneath witches and wizards, and it is their existence, their very being to serve, and just some people treat them worse than others. And Hermione is really the only one that says, hey, this isn't right. J.K. Rowling doesn't even describe it in the book for the reader to really think, oh, this is awful. Although you do think it's not fair, but you're not thinking, hey, you just think, hey, it is what it is. And then you think about it and you're like, wow, that's really what it was like.
Yeah.
For people
that's
to
cool.
think about way back then. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even in this movie, I mean, Harry undergoes a little arc, where he does see Dobby, at least in the way that he speaks to him and treats him. He does, treat Dobby like this little irritation, and that's how Dobby is presented. So I think that actually helps that last moment with the sock and everything. And it's really nicely done. It's really not really walloped over anybody's head the way that it's
right.
That could be in a kid's movie.
Well, that's right, and when one character does it, and it's a little annoying, and it's meant to be a little annoying, you don't get, I think that's a brilliant way to not be heavy-handed with something, but still present it, you're not making fun of it because the author agrees with the message, but you're not hitting the readers or viewers over the head with it. So.
Right, yeah, you're not preaching. Yeah, I mean, in general, I think that this is just a really well-meted out, well-paced adventure movie, and I think that last week a big part of my nitpicks had to do with Chris Columbus's direction and just his choices of shots, of lenses, of setups, and the special effects. Everything seemed like it was kind of a first draft. It was a rehearsal more than a movie. And it literally is like a different person directed this movie. Clearly they got, an extra $25 million or something for the special effects, because all the special effects I think are fantastic. I feel like they maybe even constructed some puppets for the Archaeopteryx, bird thing, I forget, the Phoenix guy at the end. And also Basilisk head, I feel like, was a practical. It looked really good, but all the CGI looked really good too, considering the amount of time that's passed since the movie came out. But just the shots, just the way that he moves around the characters in the space and making the space as important as it is, I feel like he really does a great job in this movie. And it's the first Harry Potter movie I feel like that I watched. Where I was like, oh, okay, so even if for some reason I can't get on board with the story with these movies, which of course I did, but even if I couldn't, visually, these are still going to give me a lot to have fun with. And I feel like this one is a huge leap forward.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name. Maybe you know him. I met the guy that did all the practical effects. Like built the Chamber of Secrets door and stuff like that when I was at the studio in London where they keep all of these sets in a warehouse. He was actually there kind of showing. He also builds the door to Hogwarts in the next movie that with the big beams that lock it. And he was showing, he was demonstrating how it works, and the snakes on the door were moving and everything. And I got to talk to him afterwards. His dad worked on Lawrence of Arabia, I think. So it was pretty.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a pretty insane moment, but yeah. Yeah, those effects are really great. You could tell it's kind of victim of the time that it was in, and perhaps the amount of money that it had to really do effects. But the CGI Harry, I think, it's kind of gone.
Yeah,
from the Quidditch scenes and the troll on top of the troll's head. So
yeah, what's crazy is that, like, last time I was saying the Quidditch thing, despite the questionable or dated effects, was one of my favorite parts of the movie because it was kind of exciting. This time around, it's the opposite. The Quidditch didn't really do a ton for me, but everything else in the movie really worked. And that the whole spider attack sequence, I think, is great, and a part that I always forget about. Just overall, I feel like this really strikes that tone of the kind of kids' adventure movies that I appreciate, where things are scary. You know, there's a definite there are definite stakes and danger to everything, and I really like that.
When you mentioned that the first movie kind of looked like the effects kind of looked like a first draft, do you mean that similar to how the inanimate objects in the live action Beauty and the Beast look?
No, those just look horrifying. Those look like melted nightmare objects. I feel like I had a big question for you to close out, but I lost my train of thought. Do you have any closing thoughts before we shut it out here?
No, I think it's a very good adaptation, and I appreciate. It annoys me when directors remove things from the books to the movie, but only when the story suffers. I actually appreciate times in this series where the director has removed things from the book, and it actually made the story better, only because of, you know, limited time, running time, and things like that. So, you know, the first two movies are pretty much spot on, you know, if you're trying to make a book into a movie. It's the next movie, Prisoner of Azkaban, that I question, because, you know, you talk about being able to just to appreciate it for it being a movie. If you don't know anything about the books, I know you're confused from some parts of Prisoner of Azkaban. And so maybe we can just kind of flush that out a little bit on the next
one. Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I thought of that thing I was going to ask you.
Okay, cool.
How does the basilisk move around Hogwarts? I know that they say the pipes, and I understand, like, okay, fine. It's like the interior pipes of the walls and stuff are that big for the basilisk to move around. I guess I'll buy that, but there are no outlet pipes, you know, where it can get out. Was it going back to that bathroom, like, through the hall every single time? And if so, how did anybody miss it?
Well, I have an I can explain that because of just – it may not be the right explanation. It'd be more of like a debate explanation. But I believe it went back to that entrance every single time, because that's how you get out of the Chamber of Secrets, which Slytherin built many years ago and had to hide it as they developed Hogwarts more and more. He had to hide it in the girls' bathroom. But that sounds weird. But Tom Riddle was a very, very, very gifted wizard, even at a very young age. And so he was able to – wait until no one was around, go get it, and somehow walk around the halls. And it was just, I guess, the first people it came across is what the basilisk got, you know? Even though it was the library.
Right? It would have been him and Jenny.
Jenny's the one that did it, yeah. Right.
I guess it wasn't, he was never really physically there.
That's right. It was just Jenny in the present day doing it, yeah.
Maybe buy that he also gave her some sort of invisibility or shrinking spell to help them be covert in it. Okay, I'll buy that.
The basilisk?
I guess I buy the idea that Tom Riddle gave her some sort of way to, you know, get around without being seen.
I don't know. I'm thinking maybe she just walked around.
I don't buy that. I can't go that far, just because, I don't know. This is stupid. But anyway, I feel better regardless. Like you said, there's a conversation to be had about that. I did fail to mention something last time that I'll mention here before we close out, and that's Robbie Coltrane as Hagrid. I think he is just so great and such a great fixture of these first few movies, especially. I feel like he goes away in the later movies for whatever reason.
Is that... Sorry.
No, that's all I was going to say. I was just going to say he's great.
Who? Sorry. I missed what you said.
Hagrid. Yeah.
His moments get a little bit less and less, unfortunately. But yeah, he's awesome. He's one of the better characters. About that, I think technically, whenever the basilisk was out in the hall, it was when all the students were not supposed to be out.
Right.
Technically, and so if the student was out, he or she was breaking the rules. So every time the basilisk came out, anybody it got was like the cat, which, okay, you know, the rules don't apply to cats as much as they may think otherwise. But like Hermione was doing research in the library, she wasn't supposed to be out, you know, that's my explanation, is that it was after hours, they had locked the hallways because, you know, there's danger in this children's school. But, you know, kids break rules, and then you get petrified when you don't follow the rules, which is the moral of the story of the Chamber of Secrets.
Absolutely, and it's
something obey yours.
Yeah, it's something that I tell my daughter every morning, every day. I leave voicemails at home letting her know that if she disobeys us, she will be petrified.
She's got the obey giant poster on her wall.
Uh-huh, and only a screaming plant will save her. All right, man. Well, this was good. I feel better about that question, and I'm excited about the series going forward because, like I said, this was a movie that I wasn't crazy about, but I ended up really liking, and I know I'll like the other one. So maybe everyone will be even better than I remember it.
Yeah.
All right, Craig. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.